Welcome to Scope It Out. In this episode, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Devyani Lal. They will discuss the article, Unsupervised Network Mapping of Commercially Available Immunoassay Yields, Three Distinct Chronic Rhinosinusitis Endotypes. This edition of Scope It Out is sponsored by Medical Center Pharmacy, leaders in topical sinus therapy for chronic sinusitis and polyp patients. Founded in 1990, MCP provides innovative formulations that combine steroid, antibiotic, and antifungal treatments. These medications are instilled directly into the sinuses using various devices. Successful insurance billing, thorough patient education, and prompt delivery are why physicians and patients trust MCP as their premier pharmacy. Please visit www.mcpnc.com or call 1-800-930-8785 for more information.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Devyani Lal from the Mayo Clinic in Scottsdale, Arizona. We will be discussing her article, which is currently available in Early View online, and it's entitled Unsupervised Network Mapping of Commercially Available Immunoassay Yields Three Distinct Chronic Rhinosinusitis Endotypes. That's a mouthful. Devyani, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's an honor.
Well, thank you. I found your article really interesting because it seems that it will certainly be critical in terms of making progress in the management of this disease to figure out how to endotype our patients in the clinic, not just in the research laboratory. And I guess, said another way, we have this disease that we call chronic rhinosinusitis, and it impacts millions of people, perhaps tens of millions of people. And we've come to realize over the years that we're really talking about a syndrome potentially consisting of many different disease processes, and then we're lumping it under this one term, chronic rhinosinusitis, or maybe two terms. We will divide it up into chronic rhinosinusitis with nasal polyposis and chronic rhinosinusitis without nasal polyposis. And as clinicians, we all know these patients can be divided into a variety of different subgroups based on their phenotypic presentation and even their response to a variety of therapies. And you've attempted really to endotype the disease using a commercially available tool, and you have some really interesting findings to present. So before we jump into those findings, talk to us a little bit about what endotyping means and why endotyping is important.
So, Tim, thank you for that great introduction and the great overview. And the concept of phenotyping and endotyping, I think, is so important in the management of chronic sinusitis, particularly the disease in patients that are very, very hard to manage. And as clinicians, we are all aware of these patients. And I think it's important to start distinguishing features that make our patients much more difficult than the average patient that responds easily to either medical treatment or surgery. So the concept of phenotyping came into our literature a few years ago, and the most basic definition of phenotyping, as if you look at the dictionary definition, is basically features that can distinguish one organism or one disease from another that are easily identifiable by others. For example, if you look in the nose and you find polyps, well, that's a feature that you easily identify and you say, hey, you got chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps, or you don't have nasal polyps. And by the same token, if you've taken a history and you say, oh, you know, my airway really seizes up and I have difficulty breathing when I take aspirin or ibuprofen, then that's also a phenotypical characteristic where the patient's feature is telling you, this is more likely to be aspirin-exacerbated respiratory disease. So these are features that can be observed by an observer, and you can make a feature-oriented diagnosis. Endotyping takes it a little bit beyond that. And what we start doing with an endotype is looking at features within the individual that needs an added test or investigation that's not easily distinguishable for us. So, for example, in that aspirin-sensitive patient, if you look at the urinary LTE4 level, the leukotriene level, then you may be able to say, okay, this is an endotype. We know that there are certain patients that actually have aspirin-sensitive symptoms. They do not react to aspirin, but they may have problems with ingestion of beer or alcohol. Certain food types may increase nasal congestion. These patients oftentimes have elevation of the urinary LTE4 levels, which are also seen in aspirin-sensitive patients. So it is potentially possible that aspirin-sensitive patients just have a higher, more severe degree of that endotype, and that matures into a phenotype. For example, we know that some patients have very high levels of eosinophils in their polyps. Some patients don't. So if you look for that level of eosinophil levels in the serum or the tissue, then that's also an endotypical characteristic that you can test for.
It's interesting that we know that these phenotypes that we've held so close and dear over many years now are really very gross categorizations of this disease. And they really, I mean, when we've looked at outcomes and things, they really don't give us a lot of information about response to treatment or even prognosis in the disease process.
That is entirely correct, and it's very interesting that you mentioned that, because response to treatment in itself can be an endotype, because if you look at the asthma literature, they divide their endotype or their phenotype as corticosteroid sensitive and corticosteroid resistant, and we've never done that, although we know that some patients that have CRS have exquisite sensitivity to a burst of prednisone, and some of them don't. So that's one way to look at some endotypical characteristics as well.
Right. So endotype is very distinct from a phenotype. A phenotype's an observable characteristic or trait of the disease, whereas the endotype really describes a more distinct, I guess, pathobiological mechanism of disease.
Absolutely. And to the listeners who want to look more into what an endotype is, there are actually two or three very good documents that one can refer to. The first one came out from Klaus Bockert's group, and it is called the PACTOL Consensus Report. And then we also have our own ICAR report, which delves into it. Those are two good reference points. And if you look at the Bockert group report, they basically identified many ways in which we could look at these endotypical characteristics and many metrics that can be employed to look at that. For example, the presence of autoimmunity, the levels of IgE levels in the serum, the levels of eosinophils in the serum, the presence of fungus in the tissue, the presence of fungal hypersensitivity in patients, the response to treatment. So that's a good document to refer to.
Right, and you also mentioned the International Consensus Statement on Chronic Rhinosinusitis that is also published in IFAR in the last year, and it delves into some of these concepts as well. So you described three distinct endotypes. Can you give us an overview of those three endotypes?
If you look at the studies that have been done previously on endotypes, and again, Klaus Bockert's group came up with a study where they looked at polyp patients, and they selected some chemokines, interleukins, etc., and they sort of ran these assays and divided. They came up with 10 subgroups of patients. So these are polyp patients, and they had 10 subgroups. Each of these had different characteristics. Now, this is very interesting from a clinician's perspective. But it's very impracticable if you are trying to translate those into a clinical atmosphere. So our proposition was to find if we could identify any distinctions in patients of chronic sinusitis that had surgery and that we had tissue for, and see if we could find something that is commercially available, easily available, and still identify any endotypical features. So what we did was to take a commercially available assay, and basically it looks at 41 different cytokines, and the details of the manufacturer are available in our paper. And we looked at that, and there is another assay that we looked at. It's called major basic protein, which is something that is associated with degranulated eosinophils, which we all know are key players in chronic sinusitis. So we took this assay, and what we did is we had about 32 patients for which we had samples. And so six of these were controls that had surgery with me for reasons other than sinusitis. For example, they had orbital surgery or nasal septal deviation, et cetera. And then the other group comprised, the 26 patients comprised of patients that either had polyps or didn't have polyps. The title is long in our paper, which says unsupervised network mapping. But that's actually a really nice way to look at it, because two things happened by employing this multiplex assay. One, we did not actually presume that we knew what chemicals were important as an endotype. So we were able to just use this assay, and whatever was in this assay, we sort of used it. So it was almost like an unbiased approach.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, my co-author on this, Rohit Divekar, is an expert on network mapping. And what network mapping does, it just looks at patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not to say that you have a level of serum IgE level of 34, so you fall in the group of 0 to 100, and then there's another group of 100 to 200. What basically network analysis does, it groups together like with like. So with this assay of the 41 multiplex assay, this looked at the tissue, and then it basically clustered around three groups. In one group, we had a high level of chemicals or inflammatory mediators that are associated with a Th1 pattern. And I'll come to that, why that is important. Another group, we had something that was more Th2 dominant. And then
group one is Th1 dominant. Group two was Th2 dominant. And then there's a third group.
Yes, and that third group had Th17, and it was sort of a mixed group of clusters. Why is that important? It's important because when we look at polyps in the United States, most of the polyps have a pathogenesis based on a Th2 inflammatory pattern.
And let's just, for our listeners, Devyani, the Th2 pattern is thought to be an eosinophil-driven pattern of disease. These patients have, phenotypically, they have nasal polyposis. They have a lot of eosinophils in their tissue, if you count eosinophils in their tissue. And then they have a couple of very characteristic interleukins that show up in the molecular analysis.
That is absolutely correct. Th2 patterns of inflammation are associated with high levels of eosinophils. They have high levels of MBP, the major basic protein, and they have high levels of IL-5 and IL-13. And keep that in mind because we'll come back to those two chemokines, IL-5 and IL-13. And these appear to drive most of the polyps that are present in the United States. Now, coming back to the Th1 and Th17 dominant patterns, these are associated more with a neutrophilic-driven inflammation. And in the United States, they are associated more with patients that don't have polyps. So some other pathogenetic mechanisms other than Th2 mechanisms are found in these patients. What we found when we did the multiplex assay and looked at the clusters, we were able to identify three very distinct clusters where the chemical assay is clustered. One was Th1, all of them clustered together in the tissue. Th2 clustered in another group. And then in another third group, we had a mixture of everything. So this
right.
was just completely unsupervised. We just looked at that. The next thing we then did, which was not blinded or unsupervised, is then start looking at the patient characteristics. And before we did that, we again did an unsupervised network clustering of the patients. And the patients again clustered in three distinct groups. So in one group, we had patients that had mostly polyps, and about 50% of them had asthma. And then in another group, we had patients that did not have polyps, about 60% of them had no polyps, and then some of them had polyps. And in a third group, we actually had controls and CRS with nasal polyps. So what this tells us that just by looking at the characteristics of the patients, they were in themselves able to group themselves in three groups. Then we did the networking between these two clusters. And what was interesting is that in patients that were polyps, we found that they clustered very strongly with a cluster that had Th2.
Yes. So polyps clustered with Th2. That makes sense.
Yes. And then one group that was majority predominantly without polyps clustered with Th1.
Okay.
And then the controls and some of the non-polyp patients went with this third group of non-specific chemicals, which had mostly growth factors in it.
That's interesting. This group three is the one that interests me the most. It kind of seems like a wastebasket. I mean, something like 62% of the patients did not have polyps. Is that right? Or something thereabout. They were kind of middle of the road on everything in terms of major basic protein, tissue, eosinophilia. They just kind of fell in the middle, it seemed like. Is there any distinguishing characteristic of that group three? Because I think we've all heard the Th1 profile, the Th2 profile. Is there something that you can distinguish in that group three?
So group three mostly comprises of a mixed basket of control patients and patients that did not have polyps.
Okay.
What came out strikingly from the study is if you had polyps, you were almost always going to either fall into cluster one or cluster two. Cluster two was the one with the Th2. But
right.
What was interesting is some of the polyp patients actually fell into cluster one, which was the Th1 neutrophilic pattern of inflammation.
And clinically, we've seen that in diseases like cystic fibrosis, where those patients tend to have, or they certainly can have polyposis, and yet they have more of a Th1 profile. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely, absolutely. We didn't have any patients of cystic fibrosis.
Right,
in this group.
Right,
but
right.
If you look at studies from China, their polyps tend to be neutrophilic.
Yeah.
So I think that the assumption we make in our population that all of our polyps are driven by eosinophils may not be entirely accurate.
Right.
Because in cluster one, about 60% of the patients didn't have polyps, but then the rest of them actually did have polyps. We have to be cognizant of that fact.
Yeah.
Bottom line, what we could say from this study is, in essence, our phenotypical characteristics of characterizing patients with polyps and without polyps is actually not inaccurate. We can make gross assumptions about what kind of inflammation is driving them, but
it has certainly withstood the test of time. We've divided patients that way for, feels like, decades now, and we do see differences in those two patient populations.
Right. What I take from this study is the patients that are easy, they are easy to characterize. It's the difficult patients where we are scratching our heads to figure out what's going to work with these patients. And that's when going beyond the Th1, Th2 pathway and looking specifically at the endotypical characteristics as what are the chemical mediators of such inflammation might be useful. For example, if you look at our cluster 2, we find that they had high levels of IL-5 and IL-13.
Mm-hmm.
We found IL-4 to cluster with cluster 3, which was this non-specific waste basket.
Right.
But the newer drugs that are coming out that are biologic and they are being tried for recalcitrant polyps, for example, dupilumab,
works
against both IL-4 and IL-13.
Right.
So that drug may actually be working on two different mechanisms and may work on two different kinds of disease processes.
So to summarize that briefly for the listeners, dupilumab, it's a new biologic agent that's out. It's been greeted with a lot of excitement. It's an antagonist for IL-4 and IL-13 pathways. So based on your endotype, the groups you found, it might be useful in group 2, which is where they've been studying it, that is patients with Th2 inflammation and polyposis, but it might also be useful in group 3, and many of those patients do not have polyps, actually.
Right, right. It's hard to make those assumptions with the number of patients that we had.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that even with such a small number of patients, we had some very, very high clustering of chemokines as well as the patients.
Yeah. And so are you using this clinically in your practice? How much does it cost? Can you answer those questions?
So we're not using them in practice. And for a multiplex assay, you can group them and batch them together, and it will probably cost about $4,000 to $5,000. So this is not in the clinical realm. But what we do use in clinical practice are things that are more easily available for endotyping. And actually, we are presenting some of that data at the American Rhinologic Society meeting, where we've presented our approach to endotyping, because some of the factors that we can use is very, very easily available. For example, what is the level of serum IgE level? You can get them their standard of care. You can look at the level of IgE, and that will give you two things. It will tell you whether standard therapy is failing, whether there is applicability of something that can be used, which is currently off-label, but anti-IgE can be utilized, especially with patients with severe asthma, polyps, and high IgE. The other things that we look at are serum eosinophil levels. For example, if your eosinophil levels are high, patients have polyps, then one of the things we do is always look for what was previously called Churg-Strauss vasculitis and is now called eosinophilic granulomatous polyangiitis, or EGPA. So those are things that we can look for. We started looking at urinary LTE4 levels for younger patients with polyps because they often seem to fall along that aspirin-sensitive spectrum, even if they haven't actually manifested into that. So there are several things we can use from a clinical perspective, but this is something that hopefully we can utilize in the future, but currently this is too costly.
Yeah, I think this whole concept of endotyping, you know, it's really fascinating, especially as we enter this era of precision medicine. And in the end, chronic rhinosinusitis is probably a conglomeration of rare diseases. And what precision medicine intends to do is take these common diseases like chronic rhinosinusitis and break them down into many distinct rare diseases and then treat them at the molecular level. And your work gives us some insight into how that will occur in the years to come.
There's something I say to some of the patients and the residents that come through. If I could make a last analogy, if a patient comes to you with hepatitis, you just don't tell them you have hepatitis. You tell them you have alcohol-related hepatitis, you have viral hepatitis, and if you have viral hepatitis, you don't just stop there. You go, okay, this is hep B, hep C, hep A, and so many other features of hepatitis. I think that we need to propel this idea of chronic sinusitis, endotypes, and distinct subtypes into the clinical and educational forum because we need to understand that our patients are all different. And perhaps some of these patients will cluster together in strong groups, just like a hepatitis A, B, and C patient will behave very similarly. But chronic sinusitis is not one disease, and chronic sinusitis with nasal polyps is not one disease. Neither is chronic sinusitis without nasal polyps because a patient who has acute sinusitis or recurring acute sinusitis or acute on chronic sinusitis because they have a dental infection is going to be very different from a patient who has cystic fibrosis or a patient that has obstructive pathology.
Sure.
So we've got to start thinking like this because not because it's research-oriented, because I think it has practical relevance, and I think it can make a huge impact on the success that we achieve on behalf of our patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, listen, I really enjoyed the conversation. Hope our listeners did as well, Devyani. And you continue with your excellent work, and hopefully we'll be able to become more precise about our endotyping as the years go by. And I certainly look forward to your future studies. Thanks so much for joining me today, Devyani.
Thank you to you and the IFAR Journal.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.